This is Michael Davies, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee on the 19th of November, 2011. Michael Davies, Part 2.
Yes, this spooky feeling, I have never experienced it in my life. During the relief, there was the ship's crew, there was the people who had been on Halley Bay, and there was us new lot coming, people milling about left, right and centre. And all of a sudden, after a lot of work, fortnight of work, there was just 21 people and a snowcat on the sea ice. There were two main hawsers to ice anchors holding the ship in. And they... and it's right, the time has come, we've got to go. And just as that was said, the sea mist rolled in. And I was just suddenly conscious, blow me this, what have I done? Just these 21 strangers and this ship, which was moving sideways into the fog. And as the outline of the ship became all blurred, you saw the blurry lights from the portholes and the bridge. And blow me, right at that point, someone started with a set of bagpipes. I can picture it. He was a boatman at South Georgia, and I don't know whether it was a lament or what, but it was one of his quieter, it wasn't a non-marching type song. And this ship slowly disappeared into the murk with the sound of these bagpipes. And we were stunned to silence. And then you heard ding, 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 ding. And then the gentle thrash of water. And the ship just disappeared. And we just stood there, mesmerised. And then someone said, right, come on, right, that's it.
That was the Halley.
When I went into Halley. So as to a man, we all turned through 180 degrees, climbed on board the snowcat and went back to base. But it was a spooky, eerie, real, oh, out of some film it was. There, Rothera.
You were deputy base commander of Rothera and fire officer, and also think the mastermind behind trying to get the desalinator running.
God, yes.
Tell me about the desalinator, because that sounded like it was a pick of a job.
It was the base. Amazing base during the winter, built to house 50-odd people, just 12 of us during the winter, like little mice in a windmill in Old Amsterdam, playing merrily. And, of course, during the summer, with all the new people, water was at a premium. You had to have water. We needed water. So it was deemed that a desalinator would be a good idea. We got it going. I don't know about an engineering exercise. It was a basic work to finish the drain from the desalinator room down to the sea. It was just basic engineering work, really. And eventually came to strike up the boiler and pump in seawater and try to convert this seawater into something that was drinkable. And it very quickly became apparent that for every gallon of fuel spent on producing, changing seawater, and at the time I didn't cotton on, I was producing laboratory pure water. The expenditure was horrendous. And then it dawned on us that perhaps we didn't need the fresh water, laboratory standard pure. We could do with a little bit of salt in it, and it didn't need to be filtered, it didn't need to be this pure. So the ratio of fuel to fresh water became a far better, more reasonable ratio. But it was still a frightening amount of fuel this damn thing consumed. I seem to be forever filling it up with fuel. Far more than the generators. It was just frightening. And I believe it, I'd love to see my report. Because you're supposed to do a report at the end of each year. And that was, I think 90% of the report was, God, this thing is insatiable for fuel.
Was this also the source of this problem with the earthing plate?
Well, I think that's a history with any base that's built on permafrost rock, that they cannot get a decent earth. I believe there are two types of earth, electrical and for radio earth. He said, holding his two index fingers up, inverted commas. So it was deemed that it was a good idea to try and use the sea. And I cannot tell you whether it worked or not. I've got a feeling that it cleaned the radio signals. Flo in the radio room said he noticed an improvement. Now, whether Tony the electrician noticed an improvement or not, I don't know. And of course, electrical systems have improved so much over the years. All this residual earth trips and all that sort of thing these days, where the residual earth trip measures the resistance between the various circuits, and if it rises a certain amount, it trips out. So I couldn't really tell you whether it was a significant improvement or not, but it caused a lot of pain putting that plate in the sea.
How did he go about it?
Well, we tried floating it out on a couple of 45-gallon drums. And the idea was, once it was out to sea, 20 or 30 yards, we would then shoot the drums with a 303, so they would then sink. But that was a waste of time. And because we didn't have a boat, you see, so we tried using a crane in backing the muskeg into the water. But we were very conscious that we had this gently shelving beach, and then it suddenly dropped off, literally like the edge of a table. And no way was I going to send a telegram back saying we've accidentally lost a muskeg into the sea. So we ended up, after several hours of mucking about, of picking this plate up, walking into the sea, and on the count of three, just heaving it over this edge where the shelving bit finished.
With some sort of wiring attached to it.
Well, yes, indeed, the electrical cable and the chain attached to it. And it actually did knife itself over the edge, we believe. But, of course, you don't walk into the sea and then walk out again and think everything's fine. It's just so incredible. Within minutes, you're starting to lose muscle function. And we had happened to have a snowcat down on the shore, and we all struggled to get in the back of this snowcat, and it took us the 100 yards up to the base, and we all needed a hand to get from the back of the snowcat into the base where we could undress and get warm again. It's just amazing how the cold just wrecks your body. You can't undo buttons, you struggle with zips. We all needed a hand to get undressed. And dignity, pride, all that went well out the window. Just get this wet stuff off us.
The Americans came to Rothera. You says here the Americans carried out an official base inspection at Rothera. Is that correct? I mean, what were they... Did they have the right to come and inspect you?
Well, I was under the impression...
You were making the arrangements, weren't you?
Yes, because old John Jewell, bless him, the base commander, he was off on one of his jollies again. I was under the impression that all the nationalities could do an official visit once every 2 years or whatever. And this was going to be one of the official visits. So there was, I believe, a few coded telegrams to Cambridge and what have you, because we didn't have that much warning. And it was, we sat round and talked about it, and it was, very quickly became a case of, well, we've got the base in pretty good order. Let them come and have a look at us. We're not going to put dicky bows on. We might get the old flag up somewhere, but let them come and have a look. And that's what happened. Whether it was the official visit, I don't know. But there's an awful lot of high-powered people turned up. And I've got a feeling that one of the very early aircraft flights made it in full of superfits. So although it was my responsibility to get the base up to gear, up to scratch, and make sure there was nothing nasty lurking about and as tidy as possible, I think by the time the Americans came, we did have some superfids there to greet them.
Superfids being
permanent members of BAS. But I can't remember who. It might have been Mr. Laws himself. I don't know.
You were there when Tim Fogg had a problem with travel on ice. Tell me about what happened and how close a shave that was.
Well, as this was quite a new base, base maintenance was pretty much at a minimum. There was a fair bit of wiring to be done, some building work. But out of the 12 of us, the general assistants and that had a whale of a time because there wasn't much call upon their time. They spent a lot of the winter months travelling. And Tim and I believe it was Rick Airy went off with a set of dogs and they nipped across the sea ice. They were playing their Antarctic Explorer a bit. And I believe there was some reason for them going. They were checking up on a fuel deposit on the other side of the field. So there was a vague reason for them going. Anyway, on the way back, I think they were a bit late in leaving. They got halfway across the sea ice and they thought, well, no, night's coming on. Let's make to this little island, camp for the night and press on in the morning. In the morning, the wind had changed direction and all the sea ice had gone. And there they were, stuck on this little rocky knoll. And it was quite serious because it was in the spring. There was a good chance that the sea ice had gone for good until next winter. And they were going to run out of rations. We didn't have a boat. The nearest proper ship of any nationality was hundreds of miles away. And it had all the beginnings of unravelling into quite a serious problem. We decided not to tell Cambridge about this for a few days to see if we could come up with something. And we were seriously thinking about, because they weren't that far away, could we make a boat out of old oil drums? Could we go and get them? Even to the point of abandoning the dogs, maybe. But if we were going to build a boat, we might as well build it big enough to get the dog team as well. And it really did concentrate our minds at the time. What the hell do you do for these two lads? Anyway, I think on the third or fourth night, the wind changed direction and blew all the sea ice back in. Although it was very uncomfortable travelling, I think they got very wet, and in no way had it refrozen, they were able to make the couple of miles back to land again. And I believe we've set someone off to meet them with a snow cat and a change of underwear. But it, we recognised in the beginning this could be serious.
Do you know why Rothera did not have a boat? It does seem rather a strange...
Well, I say that I've got a feeling there might have been some little plastic oracle that I don't think I'd have risked going to see in. I think there was something, actually. But I do feel that a small launch... Oh, yes, there was a rowing boat. I believe there was a rowing boat, and that's all it was. But I do believe a launch would have been a far better idea. But saying that, I suppose the argument is that there's sea ice there for three quarters of the year. When are you going to use it?
Well, the danger, of course, is if they've given you a boat, you might have tried using it.
Well, indeed, these things are there to be used, and you've got to try these things. And the next thing is, how thick a bit of ice will it break? And I can imagine a lot of glorious fun, but once again, oh, God, I don't think it would have perhaps been a good idea.
Whilst we're talking about security and safety and so on, one of the ever-present worries, of course, is fire. And I think as deputy base leader, you were...
Yes.
That was your bag, wasn't it, being
fired? Well,
so
I was...
Tell me about the cooperation you got over, the precautions you had to take.
Well, it was like anywhere, a public building. We had a log of trying the fire alarms. It was quite a sophisticated fire alarm system built into the base. I think it was once a month, I manually activated the fire alarm system. And I tried to encourage my colleagues to use it as a fire drill, which basically meant convening outside the front doors at a given point. Because the whole place was wood, the emphasis was to get outside. Do not go for heroics by yourself. Account for everyone first and then see what you're going to do. Well, this response to the fire drills was very, very casual. So one evening I thought I'd really go for it. Got a 5-gallon drum with the top cut out, put some oily rags in it, set fire to it, put it in the generator shed. Volumes of black, greasy smoke. I killed the power, the main switch, the main electrical switch, flicked that off, went up the corridor shouting fire. It was evening, we had darkness, we had smoke. I thought this would test the buggers. and sure enough, it was amazing to see how everyone just clicked into position. Instantly, everyone was accounted for. There was instantly one person not accounted for, and that was Tinsel, who was the generator mechanic, and he was standing by in the generator shed. So we instantly, within literally seconds, accounted for everyone. Within seconds, what are we going to do? Oh, there's a fire in the generator shed. We need dry powder, which is quite right. You don't need water in an electrical systems. There was then sort of like six abreast chaps with dry powder fire extinguishers heading for the generator shed, at which point I went, right, that's it, enough. It was a make pretend it's a drill. All right, Tints, put the power on. He flicked the switch up. It was too much for the generators, so the generators cut out. And we were then, what do you mean this? No, look, there's smoke. That's all right, I did it. And this panic of, or controlled panic, shall I say, certainly adrenaline coming out of everyone's ears, turned into absolute... I don't know about hatred, but the thought that...
They were not best pleased.
Oh, no, they were really seriously pissed off.
Who is Tinsel?
He was the generator mechanic at Rotherhat. You're going to ask me his proper name.
If you don't know, it is.
I'm afraid I can't bring it to mind. But he was a lovely lad, trained by Rolls-Royce, knew everything about diesel engines, but a young lad.
What was the general feeling about the culture of health and safety that was creeping in the late 70s? Did you embrace it with open arms?
Being brought up in an engineering discipline, there was always, with electricity, gas, hydraulics, heavy lumps of machinery, I was brought up with, you want to go steady here, think what you're doing. So health and safety was a little bit sneered at, although it hadn't come in that heavily. I understand now that they've got to wear hard hats when they're outside. I do find that strange. What's going to fall on your head in the middle of Antarctica?
Skewers.
And surely a woolen hat at minus 20 is better than a plastic hard hat. But they must have addressed that.
Two more things we must get in the next 10 minutes, if I may. I want to talk to you about your friendship with Pete Whitty and how that's a lifelong friendship that was formed at Halyard 77. Was it because you were both working in the same generator shed and couldn't actually hear each other speak? What was the basis of this relationship?
Well, I think the initial... the initial attraction was both mechanics. Closely followed that... Well, firm believers, if you're going to do something, do it once, but do it properly, so you only do it once. And I referred to having time on your hands. Sorry, that doesn't sound quite right. That you weren't pressurised time-wise, so you had time to do it properly. If you're going to cut a bit of metal, you've got time to deburr it and round the corners. It's those details that we both, unspeakingly, without any comments to each other, we both did naturally.
Perfectionists?
Possibly. Well, marrying my wife might not agree with that, but certainly in that area, yes, we wanted it right.
So were you communicating on the level above speech?
Certainly on that point... certainly working in that generator shed, that first time that we were together, really working together. Yes, you just could not hold a general conversation. And we both knew what each other was going to do and how we were going to approach the job, literally without talking. It's amazing, really.
That wasn't your last connection with Bass, because you seem to have been recruited... just after the Falklands War, in 82, to go back down, and this time to South Georgia. What was your mission?
I was part of a small team that were sent down there to just weigh up the condition of the base from Bass's point of view after the little fracas. And, it was a mess. It really was a mess. I was looking at things mechanical, generators, central heating units. I think the other members of the team were looking at the science sites. But as far as my bit of the report went, it was just, let's have a fresh start. Everything was wrecked.
By who?
By what? Uncaringness, I think. I think the people, whether it was the Argentinian forces or the British forces, they just didn't... I can imagine they just didn't have any mechanics there. So they ran the generators. They didn't think about checking the oil and water. They just ran it and ran it and ran it. And I believe one of the engines ran out of oil. And the second generator, they had two Scania generators, and they had this old Merlees. And then the second generator had got a serious problem. It may have overheated, actually. But these two generators were out of commission. And the time I arrived there, the army had put in a generator pod on a self-contained skip. They just could imagine it being plonked in from a Chinook helicopter. There's a generator set, plug it in, and away you go. And the central heating system had frozen up. And in consequence, burst all the boilers. It was just, I should imagine at the time, they were more concentrated at shooting each other than looking after the central heating. The main building got several bullet holes in it. Just lack of care, lack of maintenance. Because it would take hours, let alone days, to achieve that level of destruction, if you want. The boiler's only got to freeze once and it's snookered. They probably had a power cut one night and that was the boiler's gone. That power cut was probably caused because the generator had run out of oil. That's it, engine gone. Particularly oil failure, that it really is serious. They didn't know how to bring on the other. Oh, I don't know, it's just lack of knowledge, probably.
So, were you preparing a report for Bass about this? Was it just a simply recce, a survey?
The initial survey, I think. The first Bass people in, really. Just have a nose around. It was still in the hands of the British forces when we were there.
Mm-hmm. How was it for you to go to... All right, South Georgia was a minor battlefield because the skirmish was quite brief. How was it for you to be somewhere that only weeks previously you'd been seeing on the news?
Oh, exciting initial thought. But it was sad to see the British Antarctic base in disrepair. But it was even worse to go to the Falkland Islands. The top street, Stanley's on a slope, and the top street is called Davis Street. And those houses had suffered terribly. Mortar fire, shelling. And previously it was like going to the Orkney Islands, quiet, people, just a few people here and there, just lovely, quiet atmosphere, people just quietly getting on with it. When I went back, it was literally a military base, army personnel. Don't go here, don't do that. Checks, who are you? Let's see your pass. And it was such a change in atmosphere. And I do wonder if they'd ever achieve how it was again. Maybe after 30 years? I don't know. But of course, the big thing is the mines. You just could not leave the paved roads, because the mines in the boggy marshes were all there. And apparently mines move in bogs. What was previously a cleared area might suddenly throw up a landmine again.
How was it that you were selected to go back and do that survey of South
Africa? I think I was just happened to be handy at the time. I'd been working out in Saudi Arabia, and I'd had enough, actually. I'd had 3 years or so in Saudi, and... I handed me... that's right. I wanted to come back, and I had said to Dad Etchells for a long time about when they come to rebuild Halley Bay, I'd love to go back and help. So I'd handed him a notice at Saudi Arabia, and I was going to come back and have a summer back home. I think that's pretty much how it happened. And I was available. I'd been south before. I knew... Roughly, I'd been to South Georgia only briefly, sort of rough idea of the layout, and they just wanted a quick recce, I think.
Was that your last connection with the Antarctic?
The real rebuild of Halley Bay, yes.
That was in 19...
Oh, gosh. We're talking about the early 80s now.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember quite when. But and I felt that was a good... time to leave Antarctica. A new base, helped build it. Unfortunately, it didn't last very long. It all fell down. But there you go.
How do the Antarctic years rate in your life? You mentioned you were 60 in a few days' time.
I was very lucky. I consider myself very lucky because I ended up working with a damn fine, good bunch of chaps. My theory about a group of people working together, personally, one of the people I'd get on exceptionally well with. There's one person I would have communication problem issues with, not get on so well with. And then the rest fall in between, the mass sort of thing. I got on very well with Pete Whitty. I can't really think of anyone who I didn't get on well with.
But in terms of the experience... Of
the experience, oh, incredible, incredible. Really glad that I did it. It's one of these things, I'm sure, ex-forces people say, the more you put in, the more you get out. It was just an exceptionally good time in my life.